Welcome back to another episode of LEO Radio. I'm your host, Jim Harris.
I'm Dave McKellen.
And I can't find a better way to start off this podcast for this month, because March is Women in History Month. And this all starts in 1981 when Congress passed a bill to have the first week in March designated as celebrating the contribution that women have done to American history. And in 1995, that changed to a month-long celebration where we celebrate the contributions that women made in the United States and recognize their achievements throughout the course of American history in a variety of different fields. And this is perfect because of our guest today. Today we have Dr. Laura King. She's currently serving as the Chief of Police of McHenry County Conservation District. Prior to that assignment, she served as the commander of the Support Services Division of the McHenry, Illinois Police Department. And although she's had numerous wellness-related articles published, we're really here to discuss her most recent contribution to our profession in law enforcement, and that's her new book, Officer Safety Redefined. So welcome, Laura. Thanks for coming and hanging out with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm so honored and humbled to be part of the program.
So I just want to ask you right off the bat, tell us about your book, an overview, and what inspired you to write this publication.
Oh, sure. Okay. So there's the textbook answer and then there's the honest answer, right? And so I will give you the honest answer.
That's what we strive for.
Because of how well we know each other, Jim. So, you know, I started my work with officer wellness mainly because of my father. I'm a generational police officer, and something happened to my father as I watched him go through his career in law enforcement. When I was younger, he was my dad, and he'd take us fishing and we'd go outside and play catch and we'd do weekends at the lake and take the dog for a walk, and he was at our sporting events, and we had this good and vibrant and healthy life. And at some point over the years, as I got older, my father changed. And at first, you know, I was a child, I was a young lady, a teenager. I just thought, well, this is how adult relationships change with their children as they get older. And once I became an adult myself, and more specifically, once I get on the job, I realized that police work broke my dad. His perspective changed. He was suspicious of everyone and everything. He was paranoid about bad things happening, about something embarrassing happening to the family because of the friends that I was choosing or the situations that I was getting myself in. And once I got on the job, I realized that all these things that were happening during my teenage years, they weren't normal part of teenage existence. They were the influence of the police culture on my father. And so when I got into police work, my father was approaching retirement. And when he retired, he wasn't living the retirement that he had always talked about, that we had always dreamed about. Oh, well, when you stop working this terrible job with these rotating shifts and all of this exposure to crime and injury and hurt and death, you know, you'll be able to snap out of it and finally do all the things that you used to enjoy. You'll have time for all the things that you wanted to do. That's not what happened. Okay. He was just such a muted version, such a fractured version of himself at that time, that he was not able to recover. And so I was like, wait a minute, I do this for a living. Yeah. You know, if this is terrible that this has happened to my father, and I want to help him, but, you know, I also want to help myself. So what I say, Jim, is, you know, police work broke my dad. And I've made it my mission to make sure that no police officer's child will ever have to say that about their police parent. I don't want my kids saying that about me. Yeah. And when I started exploring the psychology of law enforcement profession and what the constant critical incident exposure might be doing to our human subconscious and our brain, even the biochemistry in our bodies, I realized very real things were happening for very real reasons. And there's also ways we can stop those things from happening with a little bit of proactive effort. The problem is nobody was talking about it that way. And because nobody was talking about it that way, a lot of us, like my father, weren't doing the things that they could have been doing to protect themselves and to keep their body and mind healthy at the other side of 32 years in this profession.
Absolutely. It's funny you say that, because you're absolutely right. Like, if you have an officer go through a traumatic experience, we immediately get them help for that traumatic experience. But what you're saying is that, and I've been working on an article myself dealing with cumulative stress disorder, all the small items that we deal with day in and day out, that it's not a big traumatic incident that's going to shock the conscious and trigger that mental health checkup. We just go to them, and then we are supposed to take self-care as we go through, but nobody ever teaches us how to overcome those small little ones that build up and build up and build up and erode your mental well-being. And
right.
Yeah.
Now, absolutely. And that article that you're writing, that could not be more on target. I mean, the cumulative stress that police officers are experiencing is creating what I believe to be a version of PTS. And we can look at it. If we are honest with ourselves, every single one of us will see it. It's not only the suicides. It's not only the deaths. It's not only the horrific car accidents. It is also the family members treating each other incredibly poorly in the domestics. It's the terrible words that we see. It's the children living in poverty. It's the fine upstanding citizen who we find out has this dark and sinister side and is betraying the people in his world. It's the executive who's stealing from the employees. All of these things that we see, they start to change our reality. They change the lens through which we view the world. And at work, that's necessary. We need that in order to survive. Okay, we can't approach our job being naive. But the problem is nobody's teaching us how to protect ourselves from carrying that over to their home environment. And this is exactly what happened with my dad, right? I'd go to the mall. I go, where are you going? I'm going to the mall. We live two blocks from the mall. You know, do you have money? Yeah, Dad, I have money, but I'm not going there to shop. You know, we're going to get lunch. We're going to walk around, whatever. You know, take some money. Dad, I have some money. I don't need any money. You know, take some money in case your friends need money. I don't want anybody shoplifting. Do you have any idea how embarrassing that would be me? And I'm like, Dad, nobody's stealing anything. We're just going for a soda, man. You know, and I know. It was just, it was bizarre. But I just kind of thought it was how it was. And it wasn't until I got older where I was like, oh my goodness, he saw so many teenagers shoplift that his assumption was going to be that teenagers that go to the mall go there to steal. And I'm his own daughter. He's the man that raised me. He knows I'm not going to steal anything,
right?
You know, but he couldn't get past it in our daily conversations. And again, I don't know if it was he was suspicious of me or the other kids that I was with, but still it was carrying over and having a negative impact on the family experience. And that's what I specifically wanted my book to address, is how this job, and more specifically, how our inability to stay well and healthy through everything that we see in this job is impacting our safety. And when I say our safety, I don't only mean the threats on the street, you know, I mean the psychological threats of the profession, but also our ability to have safe and secure family environments and safe lives outside of work hours and in retirement.
Absolutely. And that stress happens no matter what your job title is. It could be patrol out on the street, and at every level, every rank, we have different stresses, different things that go on in our life. And now Dave, he is our representative from the correction side of the thing. So, you know, Dave, you have your perspective as well too, with stress that happens within the walls.
Yeah, absolutely. So most of the time, everybody sees, as police officers, you see people on their worst day. Whatever's going on, it was their probably the worst day of their life. And that's when you interact with them. And for my side of the house, we see them on that day, the next day, the next day, going through all of their trials, going through watching them break down in front of their families. It takes its toll. And I've been doing this for 14 years, and I have noticed a change in myself. And it's because of that. It's because of what we see. It's compounded. Every day it's something different, or sometimes worse, every day it's the same. And it's the same people you're dealing with that went through the same problems. And having to see what people are charged with, what they've done, and watching them process that, it's a difficult job.
Yeah. It really is. And, you know, I know corrections has, you know, officers on the street have the challenge. Corrections has a different set of challenges, and the dispatchers have a lot of challenges as well, you know. And I started my career as a dispatcher, and with them, they get all the emergency and none of the resolution, you know, so they don't get the satisfaction of removing the kid from the challenging home environment, or, you know, giving the kid the teddy bear from the trunk, or making sure somebody's safe at the end of the day, calming everything down. They don't see any of that part, right? They're just doing emergency, emergency, emergency. Yeah. So it really impacts all branches of the law enforcement profession. And a lot of times people tell me, oh, the job hasn't changed me. And so I just tell them, you know what, like ask your wife, your girlfriend, your husband, your partner, your mom, your dad, like ask somebody who knew you before you were a police officer and who knows you now, because sometimes we just can't see the forest through the trees.
It is. And I don't care what profession you're in, every experience that you have in your life changes you for the good or the bad, one way or the other. It's an experience that you have, and you process that experience, and it changes your perspective, your point of view, your philosophy, your theory, your education. Something in you changes with every experience. So for someone to be naive to think the job didn't change them, it's just crazy.
Yeah, I would agree. But you know what that is that's denial, right? That's people not wanting to admit, you know, that they're human, that they're like the rest of us, and that this can take its toll if we're not careful.
So speaking of that, what are some of the action steps that you discuss in the book that can bring about the positive change in people?
Well, listen, this is a great question, okay? And my book is not rocket science, okay? It is practical application of proactive self-care, okay? So, I mean, really, it's just simple. Take care of yourself. Get enough sleep. Get some exercise. Eat healthy foods, spend time with people that you love. If you're going to use alcohol, use it responsibly, not to self-medicate, not to help yourself sleep. Make time in your day to do things that you enjoy. And if you don't have things that you enjoy, get out there and find things that you enjoy. Find reasons to laugh. Make that a part of your daily routine. You have to intentionally seek out the good. We have to be proactive. This book is a call to proactivity. All of us know that we fare better when we approach things from a proactive standpoint. That you know, proaction is faster, better, safer than reaction. Well, for about 200 years, police work's been reactive to matters of officer wellness, and it's got us in a very, very sorry state of affairs. In fact, this year is the first year since they've been tracking law enforcement suicides where the number of on-duty deaths was larger than the number of suicides. And the only reason that happened is because over 200 of the on-duty deaths were from COVID.
Right.
If you extract the number of COVID deaths, according to Officer Dow Memorial page, I believe we're at 123 after subtracting COVID for this year. Well, we're still at 177 suicides. So thinking that taking care of yourself is not important, or not an important issue when it comes to matters of officer safety, couldn't be anything further from the truth, because more officers are losing their life every single year because of suicide. And what that says is that we're not taking care of ourselves. I have done a lot of research into law enforcement suicide. I don't believe law enforcement officers are killing themselves for the same reason that the rest of society is experiencing suicide. I don't believe that it is this hopeless, helpless, worthless loop that they talk about with general society. Okay. And I go into it in the book, what the factors are. But basically, you know, we're used to being things being solved quick and easy. And, you know, the problem's being done at the end of our shift.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have desensitization to exposure to death because of how often we see it. We see countless people exercising suicide as an option. And we are all living in a culture where suicide is a choice that many of our brothers and sisters are making. And this is, again, warping our perspective and making it seem more okay as an option than it should be. Suicide is a taboo topic for the rest of the world. For cops, suicide is the way people die. Yeah. You know, and that changes our brain. And then you add into it a couple of the other risk factors and pour some alcohol on it, and it's just a recipe for disaster. You know, you throw in sleep deprivation and psychological fatigue, and you put a handgun right next to you, and this is a hot mess.
Yeah. We have seen now, as you know, we do a lot of promotional training throughout the country with officers who are looking to get promoted, and we help them with their testing process and help them with – we teach them the resources that they have on their reading list. We have seen a switch because anytime you have somebody taking a promotional exam, you give them a reading list, and that reading list – people will read the books on the reading list because they want to get promoted. Sure. So what we've seen is a lot of mental health awareness books, like Dr. Gilmartin's book, like books about mental health and mental awareness being put on these reading lists. And I think that is one great step for starting to teach our people, get them informed, because you have a captivated audience. They're going to read the book. And they're going to really try to digest that book. So having something like that on a reading list is good for at least to get some mental health awareness into the light. But we got to talk about it more. Yeah.
Yeah, it's wonderful. But here's the thing is, right? Gilmartin wrote that book over 20 years ago.
Exactly.
And in that book, he calls us to action. He says we have to start preparing our police for the psychological threats of this profession with the same commitment that we prepare for the physical threats. And we have failed to do so. Now, I don't believe that we would be so irresponsible as to intentionally fail. I don't think we knew back then, we understood with the same depth that we do today, what the psychological threats were and the damage that they could be doing. When we used to think about PTSD, we used to think about that one big critical incident. Mm-hmm. Now we are starting to understand the cumulative effect. We are starting to understand psychological exhaustion and how it presents as physical exhaustion in the human body. And we know now that if we are actually psychologically exhausted and not physically tired, there are things that we can do to very easily overcome that exhausted feeling and find our energy again. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much that we know now about how cortisol affects the human body and how sick excess cortisol in our systems can make us, how it can make us put on weight and get unexplained headaches and cause sleep disturbances and even lead to, you know, diabetes and cancer and all of the irritability, all these different terrible things. And we know cortisol is in the body. When we release adrenaline and the adrenaline is unused, it turns into cortisol. So we now know that this excess cortisol, it's not just from stress, it's from all these adrenaline attempts that we get throughout the day. You know, oh, there's a rescue call, a baby's not breathing. Oh my goodness, you know, you're focused, you turn your lights on, you turn your siren on, you drive as quickly and as safely as possible. You get there, the baby's fine. You couldn't possibly be more relieved, but all of that adrenaline has been flooded into your system. And unless you do something to get it out, like go to the gym and work out, it is going to sit there and it's going to turn to cortisol, and those excess cortisol levels are going to make you sick. They're also going to compromise your brain's ability to have and sustain healthy levels of serotonin, dopamine, and oxytocin. And those are the things that give you a happy brain. Those are the things that keep your perspective on reality in check and make you realize that the whole entire world isn't this terrible place that you see on your job in police work. There's actually still happy things in the world. You know, and again, if we don't have a good balance of dopamine, serotonin, and oxytocin because we're overwhelmed with cortisol, it's going to be really hard for us to remember that that's actually true.
Absolutely. So as we talked about police suicide, in your book, you referenced the Richard Seiden study. Just can you briefly go over that study with us and just tell us how you think that applies in law enforcement? How can we apply that?
Yes, absolutely. So first of all, the Richard Seiden study, I did look into it outside of the book, but my first exposure to this was in Malcolm Gladwell's Talking to Strangers. And that is an excellent book. If anybody is looking for a good read, just a ton of great perspective and very law enforcement relevant. So what Dr. Seiden did was they had all these people jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. You know, everybody's jumping to their death. And so what they did was they actually did a study. We know that police were out there. We know that they did a lot of different intervention efforts where they tried to get volunteer groups and everybody out there. And so they were actually very successful in intervening. In fact, they had 515 interventions in the time frame that Seiden studied. And so what they found, they did a follow-up, long-term follow-up with those people, is they found that a very small percentage of those people who were suicidal and were going to jump off the bridge and somebody actively, physically intervened and stopped them, and that's the only reason they're alive today, you know, he said, well, what's the percentage of people that went on to commit suicide another way? And I believe his guess was something like 50%. And if you ask the general American public, they guess that it's 100%. Well, if that doesn't work, you're going to go try something else. But they followed up with these actual people, and what they found is only 25 of the 515 people actually went on to commit suicide. That is 5%
wow.
of that number. And so the theory that Gladwell discusses in the book is a theory called coupling, that people who do contemplate suicide, they're usually very coupled to the method of suicide. And again, you know, this is a very dark topic, right? It's one that we don't really want to talk about, but it's one that we have to talk about here in law enforcement, because if you look at how cops are killing themselves, everybody knows. If I said, how are cops killing themselves? I mean, general society doesn't know, okay? But every cop knows. If you say, how do cops kill themselves? They shoot themselves with their gun, right? And it's never their personal gun, or almost never, I should say. It's their duty gun. Mm-hmm. They're shooting themselves with their duty gun. And so, I mean, my goodness, we had 177 suicides last year. I'm not saying all of them were with the duty gun, but the vast majority were. I tried to get the exact statistics, and you know, families don't always report that, and they don't want to pry, okay? But, you know, what if we could take and get, you know, 5% of that number? We would have less than 10 suicides instead of 177. Now, of course, it's probably not that simple. But you know, the question is it the moment, right? Or is it the bridge,
right?
Or is it a combination? Does 1 + 1 here equal 11, you know, where there's some synergy where it's not as simple as we're constructing it to be? This is really the nature versus nurture argument. You know, what are the environmental influencing factors that make it okay for police to make this decision? And, you know, very unfortunately, you know, it's usually a break in an important relationship, whether it's romantic or friendship, or sometimes it's even a job assignment, you know. And then often, you know, can be alcohol involved, because that compromises our decision making. Very often there's a lack of sleep. And I say that because that lack of sleep exists for most of us law enforcement officers in general. And the lack of sleep compromises our ability to make decisions. We all know that. We all know when you're without sleep for an extended period of time, it's like equivalent to being a 0.08, right? We all took all these studies, like,
yes.
You know, so why are we allowing ourselves to walk around super tired with guns? You know,
right.
We'd never allow the guys to come to work after having a couple beers at the bar, you know? So it's something that's worth looking at, because what if we could do something? Now, suggesting that law enforcement officers leave their duty weapon like at the police department or something like that is incredibly unpopular. I mean, you think telling them to get a mental health wellness checkup is unpopular? Try to get them to let go of their gun. Right. But here's the thing is, I don't know, and this is controversial. Not everybody's in the same place with me here. I don't know that the mental wellness checkups are going to help. I don't think these cops are becoming mentally ill or depressed.
I think
they're making a conscientious decision to not go on because they're exhausted and overwhelmed. And we know we can fix exhaustion and overwhelm with some very simple self-care interventions. Yeah.
And it's so funny you've mentioned it a bunch of times throughout this program is the fact of sleep deprivation. And we all know that an officer's or corrections officer, their one major hobby that they have is working overtime.
Right.
So we allow them to work an exorbitant amount of time as long as they have 8 hours in between shifts. But of course that we don't take into account how long it takes to get home, to come back. What are they really sleeping? And
yeah, no,
we're doing it to ourselves.
Absolutely. So the most brilliant thing I've ever done for myself was $300. I purchased myself this ring. It's called an Oura, O-U-R-A, and I am in no way, shape, or form affiliated with the company. But if they want to send me free stuff, I will accept it. it's a fitness tracker, okay? But it's not like your fitness tracker. It predominantly deals with your sleep. And it monitors your resting heart rate, your heart rate variability, the hours that you sleep, when you're in deep sleep, REM sleep, light sleep, when you're restless, all of these different things, resting heart rates, core body temperature. I'm probably repeating myself. Anyways, when I started wearing this and looking at my data and then understanding what it was that was occurring in my days that was the compromising factor, everything changed for me. I got very, very serious about, you know, you think having a glass of wine before bed is helping you sleep? No, it's not. I promise you, it's jacking up your system. It's elevating your heart rate. It's compromising your ability to get REM sleep. It's doing all these different things. And, you know, it's like I'm doing human experimentation on myself. But, right. You know, it's like, so once you have something that's feeding you data, you can crack the code. You know, you can figure out what works for you and what doesn't work for you. But I refuse to be sleep deprived. And people are like, oh, well, you're so fortunate. You're so lucky. I promise you, I'm not. Okay. I work 5 jobs. I have 2 kids under the age of 10. I'm married. I own 8 rental properties. I have so many moving parts in my world that it's not even funny, okay? But I make time for sleep. I am committed to getting enough sleep. You want to know why? Because it's the only way I have energy to do all the different things that I accomplish. If right. I didn't sleep enough, I would only be able to do a fraction of the things that I'm actually getting done.
Right.
I think I need to adopt that philosophy myself.
Yeah, that's right. Let's set you a bedtime.
Yeah, I wish.
But, you know, it's like we make excuses, right? And we're part of this culture where it's fine to eat pizza in the middle of the night, even though we're not hungry because somebody dropped off a free pizza. And it's fine to, you know, stay up for 20 hours when you're coming off of your days off when you're working midnights, because that way you're tired when you get off shift at the end of the day. And, you know, a lot of times we wear our lack of sleep as a badge of honor. You know, oh, I didn't get any sleep. You know, I had a wedding the night before, so I did this and that. And sleep was always the thing when I was a younger officer. It was always the thing that would get sacrificed. I would bid midnights so I could sacrifice my sleep at strategic times so I could try to live the life that I wanted.
Absolutely.
And what a foolish mistake that was. Now, fortunately, the body's a miracle machine, and it doesn't matter how long you did that for. As soon as you start taking care of it again, it starts repairing and responding in a responsible way. But my goodness, you know, I try to teach my officers, don't be the fool that I was. You know, you have to sleep if you are going to be expected to do this job to the best of your ability.
Midnight has been a killer for our department. It is insane. Everybody that comes off of midnights after doing 6 months, 8 months, 10 years on midnights, they come off Midnights and they say it's the best thing they've ever done.
Yeah. Why did it take me so long to get off Midnights?
100%. Yeah. 100%. It's crazy. I have never seen one person.
But
maybe
try to tell them that when they're on the shift.
Oh, no. It's the best thing that's ever happened.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Of course. I can get everything done.
I don't have to deal with administration. Yeah. I just get to come to work and do real police work. Yeah, I got it, man.
Yeah.
It's screwing you up.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly. So you talk about the like teaching our younger generation about how important it is. So that jumps into our mentoring aspect. And you do discuss mentoring and how our actions matter. So what do you propose, or how do you propose that we exemplify these ideas? How can we mentor? What can we do?
So I think leading by example is the absolute most important thing. Also, if you have any influence in your agency to cultivate a wellness program or some type of program that's encouraging officers to get physical exercise, I think our ability to mentor officers into sleeping better is very limited. You have the opportunities to talk about your healthy, you know, sleep schedule and to make comments or have courageous conversations if they're making comments about their lack of sleep. But I think really where the power lies is getting these officers to exercise. Because if they are exercising, if they are making their body physically exhausted, they are going to sleep. Even if they're sleeping for a shorter amount of time, their depth and quality of sleep is going to be better. All of us have been there, right? Where we feel so tired, we can't keep our eyes open, we get into bed and we can't turn our brains off. We lay there for hours, we can't fall asleep. Well, that's because you are not actually physically tired, you're psychologically exhausted. But psychological exhaustion presents in the human mind and body is physical exhaustion because, again, when the brain needs a timeout, it's trying to tell the body to take a timeout, you know? So encouraging things such as meditation, having your officers exercise. My officers are allowed to exercise on duty during their lunchtime and during their 2 15-minute union breaks. I allow them to put it together and get an hour workout while they're on duty. And, you know, some people say, oh, you know, must be nice. Well, listen, we make it happen. Okay. And are there days that the officers don't get to it? There are days that the officers don't get to it. But you know, what we found is that if we work out early in our shift, right? I mean, there's times when we know we're going to be less inundated with calls. And the officers are smart enough to schedule their workout time during those moments. And then they just eat on the fly. Mm-hmm. You
That's
know?
Great. That's great that you offer that.
Yeah. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily an easy thing to do. I had to get the support of my higher ups and everything. But when I explained to them why, wonderful things have happened. And, you know, our productivity, our traffic stops are up 300%. Our self-initiated calls are up 200%. And our sick time usage is down 60% in the 2 years since we've instituted the wellness program. Nice. You know, and so we also went to a longer shift, which gives the officers every other weekend off, you know, so created a little bit more of a work-life balance for them. But, you know, these were strategic initiatives designed to get them taking better care of themselves. And I had to go to bat in front of this board and say, if we don't take care of our officers, they're not going to be able to do the job that we asked them to do. They're going to come to work in a compromised state, and we're going to see a whole bunch of things that we just don't want to see. And I said, just, you know, let's just try it. And I am very fortunate that they trusted us and that we took that action and initiative. But all across the country, there are shifts and teams where the guys and gals are getting together before shift and working out if their department doesn't allow for it, or getting together after shift and working out, or, you know, running a 5K, or challenging each other for how many miles can you run this month? And then the next month is, you know, how many whatevers can you do? You know, they're finding creative ways to introduce physical fitness back into our profession. And damn it, sometimes we need to be strong in order to perform as police officers. We do not know when the fight or the chase is going to come to us. And far too many of our officers don't die because they get beat in the fight, and don't die because they can't catch the guy in the chase. But half an hour, 24 hours later, they go home, They start to relax, right? And all of a sudden, they're having a major cardiac incident.
Absolutely.
Because yeah. that, you know, that fight, that chase is the first time in 10, 20 years that they've elevated their heart rates
yeah.
because they've been too tired to work out for the last 15 years. We can't have that anymore. This is a physically demanding job. You need to take a physical fitness test in order to get the job in the first place. Keeping yourself in shape, healthy and strong, needs to be part of you staying, you know, up to par for the entirety of your career.
Absolutely. And it's as much as the majority of law enforcement believes that, you have that small minority who are so vocal because they don't want to do that. And they, that tail wags the dog. And they,
and you know why they don't want to do it? Because they're psychologically exhausted.
Yeah.
You know, nobody wants to be less than ready for that moment that calls you to perform at your best. Nobody wants to be compromised. Nobody wants to give chase, go back to their squad car and have to call an ambulance to their squad car's location because they're starting to feel that tightness in their
yeah.
chest. But over and over and over again, we see it happening in our profession. And again, we can stop it. But, you know, the fire department, my brother was a firefighter. My ex-husband was a firefighter. We're not going to talk about police and fire relationships right now, but
well,
I
just for clarity, Dave is still a volunteer fireman, and I was a volunteer fireman for 15
and
years.
And so was I. And so was I.
All okay? right. So we,
but and I know there is, right, the police fire department love-hate relationship, but the fact of the matter is we can learn a lot from their culture because they're allowing people to work out on duty. They're calling people to the test. They're saying, hey, brother, man, sister, you got to work out. Come on, get your butt in the gym. We've got to do this, you know, because they know how physically demanding their job can be. Now, because they're slinging hose and carrying people up and down flights of stairs, a lot of times it's physically demanding more frequently than the police job is physically demanding, but they take care of each other better. You know what else they do, at least in Illinois? If you have a heart attack 24 hours before you go to work or 24 hours after you get off shift and you're a firefighter, it's considered an on-duty heart attack because they know the stress of the job mm-hmm. doesn't start and stop when you punch a clock.
Yeah.
In Illinois, they have that for the firemen, but they don't have it for police. I would love to see if they impose that rule on police professionals, that standard of what's on duty and what's not for cardiac incidents. I would love to see where our numbers for police on line of duty deaths fall, because
yeah.
my guess is very quickly that that would become number one.
Yeah, that would be an interesting number to see.
It would yeah. be. All right, so as we bring this to a close, in the very beginning, I discussed the how it was nice to have you on because you know, we're celebrating Women in History Month. And just before we close, is there any last-minute items you would like to say to the next generation? And since we're talking about Women in History Month, is there any woman in history or any woman in your life that you looked up to and was your inspiration to get you where you are today?
Well, you know, there's so many, you know, women in history who've done wonderful things from, you know, Susan B. Anthony fighting for women's suffrage, for Amelia Earhart, who, you know, test the limits and boundaries and prove that she could do anything that you know, a man could do, to, you know, more recently, Mother Teresa, who proved to us that you don't have to accomplish big, huge, heroic things. You could just do small things every single day. With great love and bring about positive change in the world. I think that all of us, woman or man, police officer or firefighter, right, are called to bring the best of ourselves to a profession in public service. And if we really want to be truthful about serving the public well and serving our professions well, we've got to get proactive about taking care of ourselves. We traditionally, historically, give and give and give to others. All of our time, all of our effort, all of our energy, we spend giving and caring for others. And when we get home at the end of our day, we've got nothing left for ourselves and the people that we love the most. That has got to change. That is a recipe for disaster. Too many of our brothers and sisters in law enforcement have suffered through it. We see the suicide rate, we see the divorce rate, we see the addiction rate. These things don't have to be our reality. A career in law enforcement doesn't have to mean that you sacrifice your health and your happiness along the way. We can be happy and healthy and productive and probably even be better at our jobs than we have been being by just taking a little bit better care of ourselves.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. Before we close, if anybody would like a copy of Officer Safety Redefined, how can they get a copy of that?
Well, I think the quickest and easiest way is it's available on Amazon. So, you know, you just go to Amazon, put in Officer Safety Redefined, or put in Laura King, and you will find it. But I also have a website, which is www.mentaldominion.com, and there's links to the book there, but it just takes you to Amazon.
All right, well, that'll bring us to the end of this podcast. Dr. Laura King, thank you very much for joining us. Dave McGowan, is always a pleasure. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to reach out to us, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast is brought to you by the J. Harris Academy of Police Training. J. Harris Academy of Police Training is based in New Jersey and provides law enforcement training services nationwide for promotional examinations, use of force, supervisory development, and other key areas within law enforcement. This podcast is utilized to discuss key topics occurring within the profession. The opinions and information provided is for entertainment purposes only. In an effort to provide this, we often purposely discuss opposite views and opinions to spark conversation and develop discussion points. The contents of the show and show notes are all copyrighted. All blog posts, podcasts, and show notes that are distributed to the public for free can be redistributed via hard copy or electronic copy for free only if the J. Harris Academy of Police Training is included as the acknowledged author within the actual media that is redistributed. This entire disclaimer also applies to any guests or contributors to the podcast or blog. Under no circumstances shall the J. Harris Academy of Police Training, any guests, contributors to the podcast or blog, or any employees, associates, or affiliates of the company be responsible for damages arising from the use of the information provided.